Welcome to the Growing Leaders Podcast. We're so excited that you have joined us today. With me, as always, is our fearless leader, Tim Elmore. Tim, are you ready to get this thing started?
I'm not just ready, I'm excited.
That's great. Well, as always, you know, if you've been following us for a while, we love to bring incredible leaders with great insight into these conversations, and today is no different. We have with us Jeff Idelson, who is the president of the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum. It's located, of course, in Cooperstown, New York, and I know Tim especially is excited about talking some baseball today, so absolutely. Take us away, Tim.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. Jeff, we're very excited to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us on this program.
Hey, thank you, Tim, and thank you, Andrew. The pleasure's all mine.
For you listeners, let me tell you the connection. There have been a couple of times I've been up to Cooperstown, New York, to speak to the students, the educators in that area, but I always find time to make it into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And Jeff, you and I got to have breakfast together. It was so much fun for me because I'm a nut about baseball, as you are, but it was so fun to engage in conversation and just talk not only baseball, but what it means to be a great person on and off the field. So if you don't mind, I'd like to start in with your story. You have been interested in sports, and you set a goal in school to go into athletics. It didn't work out fast. Would you mind just kind of telling your story? Because I think listeners would really be intrigued by how it all worked out.
No, sure, I'd love to. It's funny because your parents, if they're doing their job, are going to help you identify what your passions are in life. And as you get into high school and college, you always want to try to see if you can follow your passion, because you can always go back and do something you hate, as my mother used to tell me.
Absolutely.
And I went to Connecticut College in New London, was majoring in economics, didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, but knew I loved sports. And so I was fortunate enough to get an internship with the Red Sox 5 days after graduating from college in 1986, and I had grown up in Boston.
That's so cool.
And I couldn't, it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed what I was doing. But, when my internship ended, I couldn't find anything full time, so I was waiting tables and also producing Red Sox radio broadcasts, writing for their game program, because my passion was over there, and the waiting tables was a means to an end to make some money. And this gentleman would come in for lunch often, and he and I hit it off quite well. And I wasn't a very good waiter, but I was a good talker, I guess. And it got to the point where he asked me if I would have an interest in managing his takeout restaurant. So I asked him where it was, and he told me he had one employee whose name was Margie. And Margie and I had gone to high school together, and she was the cook, and he wanted me to manage so that he could expand the business. And short story is that he offered me $12,000 a year, which was significantly more than the $125 a month I was making from the Red Sox, but I was infinitely more happy at Fenway Park. My parents said, "You've worked this hard to try to get a job in baseball. Why don't you follow it through? You can always go back and do the restaurant gig," that kind of a thing. I thanked him, told him my plans were to try to work in baseball. And 2 years later, I landed a full-time job in baseball and have never looked back. The funny thing is when you look back at what that opportunity was, where I would have been this gentleman's second employee, along with Margie, who now runs a very successful soup kitchen in the Boston area, is I would have been the second employee of Boston Market.
Amazing.
Maybe the road less taken going to sports, and maybe I'd owned a professional team by now.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But Tim and Andrew, I never look back, because I don't feel like I've worked a day in my life.
That's so cool. Well, it was fun for me because I kind of vicariously was living out my unlived life through you. I've always loved baseball. I think I've mentioned I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the 60s and 70s. And, in the 70s, the Reds were winning, and I just got addicted, and it was just so much fun. But how cool that you stuck to your guns, found a career in baseball, and now are in an incredible job, just being president of the Hall of Fame. So could I ask you, this is just for listeners' sake, we're probably not going to learn anything, but just for fun, talk about what it's like to be the president of the Hall of Fame. How long have you been president of the Hall of Fame, and what's it like?
It's kind of like, if you want to take it down to its most basic level, it's kind of like the guy that drives up in the ice cream truck at the beach, except that everything's free. You have no enemies. Everybody loves loves what you do because everybody's got a connection to baseball. Yeah. And it's been working at the Hall of Fame has been a godsend. It's like it's equivalent to working at a small university. Our staff is very intellectual and likes to challenge. But by the same token, when you walk into a clubhouse and and you ask a Brandon Phillips for the bat he used to set a record, and the look on his face is, "You want something from me?"
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very cool. And then to rub elbows with the living legends of the games, the Hall of Famers, and to take this museum, which has a great place in American culture, and continue to see it thrive, are all very rewarding.
No doubt about it.
The job.
I think when we were talking, you talked about how you get down to Atlanta once in a while to meet with a Hammer and Hank Aaron. I thought, oh my gosh, who gets to have lunch with Hank Aaron? So that is fun. It's just got to be fun for you. That's neat.
It really is. And the thing that I've learned for the coaches that are listening is that I often am asked if there's an arrogance among these players because they're all so great. And what I've learned, Tim and Andrew, is that I really believe there's a fine line between confidence and arrogance. Mm. And to be successful and do so for a very long time means you're breeding confidence. And I think those who are arrogant are ones who can't quite get to the level of confidence they need to be. So they're a great group of guys, the Hall of Famers, and because they're confident, they're a lot of fun to be around and talk to and learn a lot about leadership.
Absolutely. Well, I want to come back to that in just a minute because I think that's a great that fine line between confidence and arrogance. In December of 2015, Pete Rose a decision was made, and I'd like you to talk about this. He had appealed again to get back into baseball. You obviously know this. In 1989, this gambling thing came out, and he was banned. His appeal was made, and he was turned down again. Now, before I pose the official question, Pete Rose was my idol growing up. I mean, Charlie Hustle, this guy was, you know, everybody, if you weren't from Cincinnati, you hated him. If you were from Cincinnati, you loved him because he just did anything to help you win, but obviously made some very poor decisions off the field. So would you mind, I'd love for you to just talk about why was he banned officially now forever and ever? At least that's what it looks like. What keeps him out? And just take a minute and talk about what happened.
Well, growing up in an American League city, I didn't hate Pete Rose, and getting to see him on Game of the Week was great for me, too. I love guys like him that just hustled, and wanted nothing more than to win.
Yeah.
But the 8 years I spent walking into Major League clubhouses every day, the first rule you saw when you walked by the bulletin board, which is right next to the entranceway, was that you won't gamble on baseball. Mm. It's the one thing you're not allowed to do, more so than anything in the sport. And unfortunately, for Pete, he has an addiction to gambling, and it's no different than any other kind of addiction, drugs, alcohol, whatever you want. He's addicted and he can't help himself. And, baseball caught up with him with baseball. He was suspended in 1991, put on baseball's permanent ineligible list, meaning that he couldn't be around the ballpark. And in terms of the Hall of Fame, people wonder, why doesn't he have a plaque in Cooperstown? This is the all-time hits leader.
Yeah.
He's done more for the game than anybody. And our rules for election state that anybody on baseball's permanent ineligible list can't be a candidate. Because even though we're an independent, not-for-profit, 501c3 museum that has a conscience and can act independently from baseball, we felt it would be incongruous to be honoring those that are otherwise banned from the game. And our rules for election are pretty straightforward, Tim and Andrew. They ask a voter to look at a player's contributions to the teams for whom he played, along with character, integrity, and sportsmanship. And I don't think that gambling passes the smell test for character in this case. And and regardless, I don't know that he would have gotten in even if he hadn't been banned from the game for life.
Now, what's interesting to me, and I'm going to say the obvious here, is obviously you're looking at issues on the field. A player's never going to get inducted if they didn't have enough homers, hits, RBIs. But then it's just as important off the field. And I know that sounds cliche, but for a parent listening here, what your child, your son, or your daughter is doing off the field is ultimately going to come back to haunt them or bless them. And that's really what you're saying, isn't it?
It is. And, I speak to kids often in Cooperstown. I enjoy children. And, I talk to them about you can be the best athlete you want to be, but character matters because, the fine line or the common thread, I should say, among all our Hall of Famers are character, integrity, and sportsmanship because they all earned their way to Cooperstown on the field in different ways. They all had different strengths and abilities, but the character, integrity, and sportsmanship, how you treat the game, how you respect the game, how you respect the uniform are what bonds these guys.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Okay, so one more question on Pete Rose, and then we can move on. it was my sense as just a regular fan of baseball that had Pete Rose done what he did but really come back and said, I was so wrong, I fully turned from this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was very genuine and believable, he might have had a chance. In your opinion, is that true, or would even any repentance have helped at all?
No, I think that may have helped. I mean, I don't have the crystal ball to know for sure, but we are a society that likes to forgive and give second chances. And, you know, basically what Bart Giamatti said, who was the commissioner of baseball at the time, was, "I'm banning you, but go reconfigure your life and we can talk again."
Huh.
You know, unfortunately, Bart died, but it's become evident over the last, 25 years that Pete has not reconfigured his life. And I think that was Commissioner Manfred's point when he made his ruling not too long ago.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So let's talk about what's the criteria for a Hall of Fame inductee? You mentioned this over breakfast. It's obviously on and off the field, but what's the criteria and why is it important?
Well, we're three entities under one roof in Cooperstown. We're a museum and library which chronicles the entire history of the game. So in the museum, you're going to find Pete Rose, even though he's not a Hall of Famer. I want to make that clear to your listeners, is that he's not wiped from the annals of the game.
Yeah.
He just doesn't have a plaque in Cooperstown. We're an education center. That's the second thing we are. And then we're a Hall of Fame, which honors the greatest contributors to the game, players, managers, umpires, executives, and those who start in the Negro Leagues. And basically, 1% of those that play in the major leagues end up with a plaque in Cooperstown.
Wow.
That's how difficult it is to make it. You'd have to go home and watch two ball games, see four teams play, 25 players a team, 25 times four is 100. Maybe one of those guys is going to Cooperstown. That's how selective it is to make it into the Hall of Fame. But the ability that you had on the field, did you certainly excel and were you the best at what you did, wrapped around character, integrity, and sportsmanship, earns you a plaque in Cooperstown, as it did for four guys last year: Pedro Martinez, Randy Johnson, Craig Biggio, and John Smoltz.
Yeah, crazy. Well, when I'm in front of pro teams, well, I'll often give the numbers, you know, how many millions of kids play baseball in America, and then by high school it's less, by college it's less, pros it's down to hundreds, you know. And so it really is this dream that so many boys, especially in America, would have. The chances are slim. You've got to play well and then live well. So that's huge. So let's talk about one of the things I was struck with when we had breakfast up there in Cooperstown was just you really do care about kids. You've got kids of your own. Talk about where that comes from and what you want most, even for your own kids, when you think about the job you have and then the kids you're raising.
Well, as a parent, and I'm fortunate in that I had good parenting as well as a youngster. Mm. You want to instill what you can, beliefs and values in the kids that you think resonate, that you think will resonate for them, and then hopefully they carry those through life. There's only so much you can affect with your kid. A lot of it, your kid has to really develop on their own and develop their own personalities and traits and styles. But in terms of what kind of a person you are, I think that is something I believe you can affect in children. And I, along with my wife, we would just try to set a very good example for them, to have them have strong convictions about how they feel, to not be judgmental, to think about character, what they're doing, to be polite. Those are traits that you can affect a kid with. And, you know, once they become a teenager, as you know, I think we had a magnet on the refrigerator tin that said, trying to raise a teenager is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. But I think a lot of parents can relate to
absolutely.
That. But I think if you have the opportunity to give them the basic values of how to live, they can carry those into any profession they choose.
No doubt about it. That's good. Good. This may seem like a kind of an off the wall question, but I'd love to get your thoughts on this next question. I think everybody would agree we live today in a celebrity culture, both in athletics, but also singing, dancing, acting, movies, film. There's just a celebrity mindset, and it's now full of social media, and of course that just breeds all kinds of arrogance. You mentioned that earlier. I'd like you to talk about the pitfalls of this culture in your opinion, and then maybe distinguish between confidence and arrogance. We do need confident kids growing into confident adults, but boy, it's easy to get cocky, and boy, that can be a downfall. What are some of the pitfalls, and then distinguish between arrogance and confidence?
Sure. Well, you know, with some of the pitfalls, and having experienced this as a parent with my own children, that not that they, in my case, they weren't the instigators, but were part of someone went on in social media. There's this great misunderstanding and misconception that you can hide behind mm-hmm. what you post on social media, that just because you're not there, you know, it doesn't mean that you're no longer attached to what you've said. And the point that I made to my kids was that whatever you decide to post on social media, and I encouraged them to be involved in social media to the level they were comfortable being so. But whatever you plan to post on social media, tell me that you would say it to somebody's face,
yeah.
that you would say it to, you know, that you can be accountable for what you are saying. And because it's digital doesn't mean it's any different.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of kids lose sight of that or aren't educated by their parents or, you know, don't get the instruction to understand that. And baseball is a game that's steeped in failure. So we learn about yeah. failure. And I don't think kids really experience failure until something blows up in social media, and then it almost becomes something bigger than it should be. So lessons learned, I guess, are to not play in the social media world unless it's something you would do face-to-face with somebody.
Yeah, I think that's a great rule of thumb. I really do. This next question is kind of a second cousin to that one. I have two kids of my own and have tried to raise them well. They're both 20-somethings now. But another factor in our culture is we're obsessed with being successful. And we want our kids to be successful as they become adults. Are there deeper core characteristics that many might miss to make an athlete a Hall of Fame caliber? I think we talked about this briefly. You talked about the caliber of people that you want in the Hall of Fame. And you don't make a unilateral decision, but here's the caliber of people. Talk about success, but talk about the broader definition, if you don't mind, for what success really looks like.
Sure. It's interesting. From a hiring standpoint, I think any young man or woman can be successful if they carry the traits of if they graduate college or in college and they can communicate, if they can think, if they can problem solve, and they're passionate.
Mm.
If you can do all four of those things, I don't care what you major in, you can come work for me.
Yeah.
If you're passionate about baseball and you can do those other things. Interestingly, I was at a leadership conference a few weeks ago in Las Vegas. Tony La Russa stages one annually for his ARF Foundation, which is Animal Rescue.
Okay.
And he had the president of Coke there. He had the president of Whole Foods. He had some other captains of industry. And it's funny listening to them because when you're a leader, you never know if you're doing the right things. You hope
yeah.
you are. The common message among all these guys was that culture matters. The culture of your institution matters, how people get along. And this goes back to the character issue, but how everybody gets along. Are you de-siloed? Do you have a culture that breeds success? And I guess what I would say is that the basic building blocks of life will ultimately lead to success. Sure, you might get lucky and discover a patent for something or be on the tech bubble, but you know, most of the world don't have that opportunity. And if you have the common traits of being a decent person, being a team player, being collective towards being part of a collective goal, then you can be part of success. You don't have to do it alone.
Yeah, that's good. And really, I think that's what life's about. It's not doing it solo, but doing it with a people that you care about and something you believe in. That's good. Excellent. So what are some steps that coaches, teachers, and parents can take to instill this kind of these kinds of core values? And this, I just want you to get practical. You don't have to go long on this, but those that are listening obviously care about students. Some have athletes under their care. What are some steps we can take to begin to instill character in young athletes?
Well, I think whether it's in the classroom or on a ball field or anywhere, it's the example you said. It's how you treat people. It's how you handle success and failure, and how the kids handle success and failure. I think making a point of explaining issues broadly that you can't assume the kids know because one kid's doing something that maybe isn't appropriate at a practice, that not making an example of the kid, but sharing the values of why it's important to do things in a certain way. Really, I think just having conversations about why we wear the uniform, how, in team sports, you wear a uniform and mm-hmm. it's important to wear it the right way. And that may seem trite and strange and bizarre, but it's all part of being part of a team. how you respect parents, how you respect the umpires, educating kids as to why you control what you can control and you don't worry about what you can't control. Yeah. I think all of these are important steps, and they're not big. It's just recognizing them as a coach or a parent, and recognizing that, you know, you can use almost anything as a teaching lesson, even if it's something bad, and trying to turn negatives into positives, and continuing to be a good leader in terms of showing kids the right way and setting a good example are all important to building character and strength into these children.
That's good. I love that. In fact, going back to something you just said amidst that paragraph there, whenever we're in front of athletic teams, particularly baseball teams, I always share one of our habitudes, and it's called Pyrrhic victory. It's built off of that ancient story of King Pyrrhus when the ancient Greeks were fighting the ancient Romans. And King Pyrrhus and the Greek army that he led eventually won the Battle of Asculum. But as he surveyed the battlefield, so many dead bodies and broken chariots, when his officer said to him, "Congratulations on your victory," King Pyrrhus said, "One more such victory and I shall be lost." And the point was, he had lost so much in attempting to win this battle, he may have lost more than he gained. And of course, in baseball, it's like it's arguing with an umpire, it's using performance-enhancing drugs. That's a short-term victory and a long-term loss. And I think it's important, I'm hearing you even say this, to teach our kids, think long-term, think big picture. You know, what you're doing may help you today, but it may not be a great payoff in the future along the way.
And I would agree with that, Tim. And I would say that those skill sets of are transferable across anything you do. I mean, you may have a hard time learning biology, you know, for instance, with my daughter in science, and she perseveres through it. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, when is she ever going to use biology? She's never going to use biology, but what it is doing is it's helping her to think and think in a certain way. But the skill sets of life that you learn when you're on a sports team are transferable to anything you do.
No doubt about it. That's good. Okay. I have a random question to kind of close out our conversation here, Jeff. You have met some very interesting ball players and coaches and managers. Talk about who is the most interesting player or players you've met over the years and why. I think that would be interesting to hear.
Interesting. I've been very fortunate to, you know, 30 years in baseball to have met a lot of interesting people. You know, I'd say of most recent vintage outfielder with the Miami Marlins, is a guy named Ichiro Suzuki, and a longtime Japanese player who came over to the United States and is going to end up achieving 3,000 hits this next season.
Wow.
But here's a guy that grew up in a very different culture, been to Cooperstown 6 times, and has a vast appreciation for the history of the game here today. And he's a real Renaissance guy. He loves baseball and art, and I found him to be incredibly intriguing. I'd say some of the managers, the Joe Torres, the Tony La Russas, the Bobby Coxes, to be able to pick their brains on leadership and how they motivate people, how they motivate players has been incredibly inspiring. Those are a couple off the top of my head.
That's fun. And there's quite a bit of difference in there. I mean, there's some transferable concepts, but such a different style along the way in managers. I mean, there's the Leo Durocher and the Billy Martin that's just yelling and screaming. And then there's the Bobby Cox or Joe Torre that just has a sage-like wisdom, it seems like, and they're a little more sedate. But how cool to have met those guys. That's just fun. It's neat.
And then their managerial style, Tim and Andrew, is vastly different than what Paul Molitor is going through today as the manager of the Twins, where he and I talk about managing millennials all the time. And
yeah.
I don't think Joe Torre has to worry about that anymore. So I'm intrigued by leadership, as you all are, and especially with disparate ages.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff, I'm so grateful that you spent some time with us on this podcast. Fun listening. I'm sure our baseball fans listening will especially appreciate it. Thanks for taking time out from your Cooperstown duties to spend some time with us, and I'm looking forward to doing it again sometime.
Thank you so much, Tim, and you too, Andrew. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Tim. Thank you for that great conversation. And Jeff, especially, thanks for taking time to spend with us here talking about leadership and all of these important things. If you are interested in finding out more about the Baseball Hall of Fame, you can visit their website, baseballhall.org. And if you are really interested, you love listening to this podcast, learning more about leadership, especially conversations about how to lead the next generation, we would love to invite you to our National Leadership Forum coming up in June. It's a great way for you to have the conversations that you're hearing us talk over the air. You can actually have those yourself around roundtables with leaders just like yourself. So we'd love to invite you to that. Again, thank you, Tim. Thank you, Jeff, for this great conversation. And we look forward to having you listen in next time.